Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, here we are again, a couple of weeks later, with the United Auto Workers on strike once more. The target today was Chrysler. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's the 10th of October today. That would be Chrysler LLC, thank you very much, as in limited liability company. Not publicly owned General Motors, which settled with the UAW last week. Not equally public, but perhaps more deeply troubled Ford, which has yet to formally deal with the union. Nobody knows how long the strike's going to last or what a deal to solve it might look like. What is likely, though, is that UAW negotiations won't ever be the same again. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
It's called pattern bargaining. Negotiate one contract, then use it as a model for the others. But each of the big three has very different concerns. General Motors has a lot of retirees, so its biggest worry was how to pay for health care. Chrysler's owned by a private equity firm, which wants the freedom to sell off assets or cut jobs. Still, with the American auto industry in its current troubled state, there's not a lot of room for disagreement. Dave Cole heads the Center for Automotive Research.
Well, the bottom line for all of these companies is that, and for the union, is really the bottom line. That is, the only job security, ultimately, is a successful, profitable company going forward.
He says workers have to realize the most generous benefits in the world are worthless if the company offering them goes bankrupt. That understanding may be helping keep negotiations at Ford on track. It's in the deepest financial trouble of the big three, and rumor has it negotiations there are going smoothly. Keith Crane edits the trade publication Automotive News. He thinks this year's negotiations may be the end of an era, that there'll be no more pattern bargaining in the future.
They're going to have three car companies that are going to be negotiating totally separately on terms, on how long the contracts will last, on all sorts of things that apply specifically to that company.
The question for now is how long Chrysler's workers will stay off the job. This afternoon, workers were piling wood for campfires because they're planning to stay out all night. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
What do you suppose happens when one of the world's two commercial airplane makers can't quite get its act together? You could start with an 85-point drop in the Dow and then move swiftly on to criticism of Chicago-based Boeing. The company announced today its much-touted new design, the 787 Dreamliner, won't be delivered to customers on time. Mark Babe is with the marketing consulting firm Reason.
Well, I mean, you know, clearly they've got egg on their face, particularly because earlier this year there were all these stories about the A380 Airbus's plane being delayed and the 787 being on schedule and everything looking good. And now suddenly you've got a similar kind of development on Boeing's end.
It's not just its act the company can't get together. Boeing executive Scott Carson said on a conference call today they literally can't put the planes together either.
The problems we've had with parts have ranged from fasteners that we've talked about a lot to clips and brackets and small assemblies being provided further down in the supply chain.
The last aviation word today goes to market strategist Mark Babe and the odds of more delays.
You know, I think at this point, who knows? Because next thing we know, Airbus could have another delay or Boeing could have another delay. I mean, at this point, I wouldn't place any bets.
You should know we looked all over for a good railroad story today, you know, just to complete the trains, planes and automobiles trifecta. Couldn't find one, though. In Washington today, the House took up a bill that would overhaul the Federal Housing Authority. It would also create a multi-billion-dollar trust fund for low-income housing. Not to be outdone, the White House unveiled its own plans for easing the woes of subprime buyers this morning. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson made the announcement. The government's going to be teaming with credit counselors in the mortgage industry to see what they can do to help borrowers avoid foreclosure. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports it's not all altruism.
In the next year, more than 2 million subprime loans are going to reset. That means these borrowers will soon be paying hundreds of dollars more each month for their mortgages. And the industry is terrified many will default.
No one benefits from mortgage defaults and foreclosures.
George Miller's the executive director for a trade group that represents investors which buy bundles of home mortgages repacked into securities. If the tide of foreclosures in America keeps rising, his members stand to lose a fortune. Will Wheaton's a real estate economist at MIT. He says there's an informal rule of thumb about losses lenders suffer when they take back a house.
It tends to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% of the value of the house, not the value of the loan, 20% of the value of the house is what you lose upon foreclosure.
So Miller's group and other big lenders joined administration officials today to encourage distressed borrowers to refinance or even renegotiate their loans.
In some sense, I think it's kind of a flip-flop.
Anthony Pennington Cross studies the industry at Marquette University. He says it used to be when you were behind on your payments and you called your lender, they'd say, sorry, we sold the loan. We can't change the deal.
If you ask the nonprofits or the people who are trying to do renegotiations early on, they got the answer was, no, you can't do it. And now we're getting the answer as well, actually, you probably can.
Pennington Cross says the industry players now realize if they don't cut deals with distressed borrowers, they could lose their shirts. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
By long tradition, a tie vote in the Supreme Court means the ruling of lower-tier judges stands. So today's 4-4 split could translate into some big bills for school districts all over the country. The justices were considering whether taxpayers have to pick up the tab for private schools for children with disabilities. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Federal law guarantees students with special needs an appropriate and free public school education. Congress said if public school systems can't provide a suitable program, they must pay for private placement using the district's federal education funds. When Tom Freston applied to the New York City School Board for reimbursement for his learning disabled son's private school bills, the city said he should first enroll his son in a special public school program. The younger Freston was already in private school when his learning disabilities were diagnosed. His parents insisted public schools couldn't meet their son's requirements. The lower courts agreed, and a tie in the Supreme Court upholds those rulings.
The potential impact is severe.
Francisco Negron is general counsel for the National School Boards Association.
The problem here is that a set of parents who might have from the outset decided that they don't want their child in public school can then place their child unilaterally without consulting the public school system and then come back for that reimbursement. And potentially it could deprive public schools of hundreds of thousands of dollars, particularly because the special education needs of children is a costly matter.
Those costs vary depending on the severity of the disability. New York City spends an average $33,000 a year on each of 150,000 students requiring special education. The Supreme Court's even split means no nationwide precedent is set. The tie was caused in part by Justice Anthony Kennedy's recusal for unknown reasons. Now, public school advocates have their eye on another case dealing with private school reimbursements that's on its way to the Supreme Court. Their hope is that Justice Kennedy will participate next time and rule their way. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A correction from the broadcast yesterday. We were telling you about how a proposed tax on private equity profits looks like it's not going anywhere in Washington this year. We said various Republican national committees had received a bit more than $2 million in contributions from private equity firms. The actual number that we should have used is just over $6 million in contributions. Wall Street couldn't generate much lift today thanks in part to that news from Dow component Boeing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whether today's UAW strike lasts a day or a year, we all know Detroit's in the middle of a wrenching change in the way it does business. We have yet to see if it's going to work, but if American carmakers can turn themselves around, it could help solve a lot of problems.
global warming, the reliance on foreign oil, those kinds of things. Vijay Vaitheeswaran's most recent book is on that very topic, Cars of the Future and How They'll Be Fueled. It's called Zoom. Vijay, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Let me dive right into this book and pick on something you say in the first couple of pages, that oil is the problem, the car is the solution. What does that mean?
Well, there's a lot of demonization of the SUV, and what we try to point out is, in fact, most of the things that we associate as terrible about the car, these are all things created by oil. If cars themselves were to use other fuels, then we would actually get a lot of the mobility, the freedom, the prosperity that's made possible by a personal transport while divorcing ourselves from all of those problems.
You say fuels in the plural. Does that imply that you don't think there's going to be a fuel monopoly as we have now with gasoline?
Absolutely. I think that we're going to have a multiplicity of fuels. And in different parts of the world, you may well see biofuels, you might see hydrogen, you'll see electricity as a fuel. There isn't one technology that's big enough to defeat oil, and it doesn't have to be.
You're depending, though, on two old line heavy industries, that is oil and Detroit, to make this leap into innovation. Are they going to be able to do that?
I think actually that the car industry and the oil industry are headed for a divorce. Cars are what people want. Nobody really wants or has an emotional attachment to the gasoline in the tank. What they have the attachment to is their cool convertible or their very safe SUV or whatever it is people go and buy. I think cars and the car industry now very clearly recognizes it has a chance to get rid of its troublesome partner because of this multiplicity of technologies, and they're investing heavily to the tune of billions of dollars in advanced batteries, fuel cells, flex fuel technology. You're finding every car maker has several bets because it's not clear what the winner will be.
You say that you think Detroit and American automakers are willing and able to move forward in this spirit of innovation that would be required for this to happen. But these are the same companies that are still making things like, Hummers, for crying out loud.
Absolutely. And don't get me wrong. I don't think that salvation is assured. I think among Ford, GM, Chrysler, and some of the other giants of Europe, they'll need to decide which of them is going to try to defend old ways of doing business, and there will be some innovators among them.
Was it you or your co-author who went to Detroit and actually rented a Hummer?
That was me.
Tell us that story.
Well, I couldn't resist when I got to Detroit Airport to do some research for this book to rent the Hummer, and I was driving it. I was still a little self-conscious, but at the rental car counter, the young guy looks at me and says, you got the big boy today, sir. Way to go. And it was much the same, driving all over Detroit, pulling in at the shopping mall, girls checking me out. And I was thinking, boy, this is another world from the East Coast or from California, where I risked getting the car keyed and certainly being booed and hissed at. And in a way, that was part of the impetus for this book. We're not anti-SUV. I mean, the Hummer is a pretty heavy and inefficient vehicle, but even an SUV can be consistent with an environmentally friendly future if you think of it this way. If the whole world drove Priuses, we're still 100% addicted to oil because every Prius uses a lot of gasoline. If my SUV is made of lightweight carbon composite material, meaning it's very efficient, and I have a stack of fuel cells in there, and I get the hydrogen from a renewable farm, I'm suddenly 100% off of oil. You're the one that's the problem driving the Prius.
Vijay Vaitheeswaran is a correspondent for The Economist. He's an occasional commentator on this program. He's also the co-author of the new book, Zoom, the global race to fuel the car of the future. Vijay, thanks a lot for your time.
It's great to be with you.
The Rwandan genocide 13 years ago left almost a million people dead. When it was over, 70% of the people left in the country were women. Most Tutsi men had been killed. Most of the Hutu men had fled. Today, Rwanda's more politically stable, and the economy is growing at a rate the U.S. might envy, almost 6% last year. Orly Halpern reports you can credit the women.
As empty bottles are whisked off tables here at Umara's outdoor bar, one man relaxes over a few drinks with his buddies. There's no sign saying women are not allowed, but look around Ramirez and you'll see mostly tables of beer-chugging men.
In Rwandan culture,
most women don't hang out in bars. Men always hang out in bars.
The bars most of times.
This is where Rwandan men spend lots of their money. It's an age-old tradition. Jacqueline Mukwagatera's husband once spent time at bars like this. But he was killed in the genocide, leaving Jacqueline with five kids and a household to run.
I won't buy beer. I spend money to take the kids to the national park, to show them tigers and lions, or to throw a birthday party for the kids.
The tragedy forced Jacqueline and hundreds of thousands of other women like her to become their own money managers and to force political change. Women can now inherit land. They hold high positions in government, and today, virtually half the parliament is women. That's the highest percentage in the world. One of those is parliamentarian Speciosa Mukundutia, who's heading self-assuredly to her office. She says Rwandan women who head households have earned a reputation for being more economically sensible than men.
We women, we plan. For example, if we have few or little money, we give priority to education of our children, our families.
Recently, Mukundutia called for gender equality in the national budget. She argues that more money should be put towards health, education, and employment, sectors where women lag behind men. A few years ago, Jacqueline got a microloan to open a supply business. Now she drives through the streets of Muhanga buying food and delivering it to a boarding school. By local standards, she's a huge success.
I built two houses, I bought a car, I put my kids through school. My husband didn't do that.
Despite her steady income, she's never gotten over the fear of hunger. Her insurance policy is in a chicken coop in her backyard. She never wants a day to go by without meat on the table.
I have responsibilities, so when I'm waiting to be paid, I can still take a rabbit or a chicken for dinner.
There is something else that drives Jacqueline to work so hard. Her husband's killers have returned to their village. For her, success means that despite the genocide, her family has not been defeated. In Rwanda, I'm Orly Halpern for Marketplace.
Coming up, big conventions, dirty little secrets.
People didn't want to know you brought your children. They wanted your kids somewhere else so you could be focused, when really it helps for a parent to be focused if they know where their kids are and they're well taken care of and they're entertained.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 85 points today, 0.6% to close at 14,078. The Nasdaq rose 0.25%, 7 points, ended at 2811. The S&P 500 lost 0.1%, 2 points to 1562. Boeing dove 2.75% after the company announced that delay in deliveries of the Dreamliner we told you about. Chevron issued a profit warning today, a profit warning from an oil company. That is, in fact, what I just said. Slipped 0.75%. Alcoa fell 2.5% after it posted some disappointing results today. Markets overseas were mixed. Britain's FTSE rose 0.25%. France's CAC 40 was down nearly 1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday.
The Commerce Department reports on international trade for September. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report. And 1,884 beers are on tap at the Great American Beer Festival in Denver. Breweries are arranged on the floor by region, giving beer lovers a walking tour of the nation's hop-kissed landscape. Awards determined by professional beer judges. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. They would probably deny it if you asked them, but from time to time, Democrats and Republicans actually do agree. The common ground at the moment is Medicare and the fact that something has to be done about it. Commentator David Frum says the two sides are saying the same things. They just don't realize it.
The new prescription drug program is expected to cost about $500 billion over its first decade. After that, it's going to get really expensive. To rein it in, the White House has proposed scaling back prescription drug benefits for seniors with incomes over $80,000, double the national median household income. In other words, a means test. All of Washington is now bracing for a good destructive fight. But let's go behind the scenes of this kabuki performance. The two sides actually agree on an important core principle. Confused? Don't be distracted. Historically, Democrats have opposed means testing. They fear, as the saying goes, that programs for poor people become poor programs. They prefer to maintain the universality of programs while raising taxes on the upper incomes to pay for them. Republicans prefer to leave taxes where they are and would rather reduce benefits for those who need them less. But from an economic point of view, there is not a lot of difference between raising taxes on a targeted population and cutting their benefits. In both cases, the program becomes a worse deal for the better off. The rest is all packaging. Of course, packaging matters, especially in Washington. But let's look inside the box. Programs like Social Security and Medicare were set up to transfer money from young to old in an era when there are lots of young and not so many old. Today, not only are the old becoming more numerous, they are also becoming much more affluent. My American Enterprise Institute colleague, the late Herbert Stein, is the author of Stein's Law. If something cannot go on forever, it will stop. Transferring money from the less affluent young to the more affluent old cannot go on forever. In its present form, it will stop. So means testing is coming. And if the phrase conjures up grim images from the 1930s, the solution also will be classic Washington. We'll return to that old policy. We'll just have to develop some new euphemisms.
David Frum was once a speechwriter for President Bush. He's now a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. If you have a solution for Medicare, by all means let us know. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. The Frankfurt Book Fair started today. It's a huge deal for the German and European publishing industries. Next week, there's a World Oil Conference in Houston, and internet types will assemble in San Francisco for the big Web 2.0 conference. Some might think professional gatherings like those are a great chance to get away from the kids for a couple of days. But smart conference organizers have realized that arranging sideline events for the children is a good way to keep stress levels down and attendance up. From San Francisco, Rachel Dornhelm reports.
If the American Dental Association is on the cutting edge of anything, it's probably tooth decay or gingivitis. But convention childcare?
If you have a voice, say yeah!
Yeah!
Say yeah!
Believe it or not, this is the ADA annual meeting in San Francisco, or part of it. It's a mobile daycare center filled with toys and art supplies. 125 kids from 6 months to 12 years play here while their parents attend classes. Laura Nichols dropped off her 8-month-old daughter. She says she and her husband need to attend these conferences to keep their licenses current, but usually they need to bring a grandparent or babysitter.
We just went to a small Arizona conference a couple weeks ago, and I brought an extra person and an extra hotel room, and we just drove to that. But still, the expense of that far superseded the expense of using the kids' camp here.
Here, Nichols pays just $40 per day. That's thanks to the ADA, which kicked in about $50,000 for the program. For the past 11 years, the ADA has hired a company called Accent on Children's Arrangements that organizes conference childcare.
We sometimes say, have toys, we'll travel.
Accent President Diane Lyons founded her company in 1991. Before that, she was an event planner. She says she hated leaving her kids in hotel rooms with unfamiliar babysitters on business trips.
People didn't want to know you brought your children. They wanted your kids somewhere else so you could be focused, when really it helps for a parent to be focused if they know where their kids are and they're well taken care of and they're entertained.
Lyons says providing daycare to conferences presents special challenges. She needs people trained to work with kids in unfamiliar environments, and she has to fly them from place to place.
We see children on a very short-term basis, so we have to have a lot of safety and security issues in place. We do computerized ID badges with barcodes and pictures.
Those kinds of measures are expensive. At some conferences, the organization foots the bill. Sometimes they'll use an outside sponsor, like a food or diaper company. Barbara Scafidio is the editor of Corporate Meetings and Incentives magazine. She says planners are happy to drop $30 an hour for each bartender, so why not $15 for childcare providers? And childcare is worth the expense, she says. Convention planners are under pressure to bring in more attendees. More people will go to conferences if they know they can bring their kids.
It's an incredible opportunity for children to see places they've never seen before, too, and have memories of their parents working that are not just about, you know, face of the computer all day or looking at their BlackBerry every minute.
It's got to be done right, of course. 12-year-old Alexis Palliser from Illinois came to the ADA meeting. She said it was much more fun than some of the trips her parents have taken her on.
I really didn't want to, like, have to go to, like, a babysitter's or something like that, or, like, sit through the classes. I've had to do that once, and it was really, really boring.
Scafidio says making kids a part of conventions can give them a better understanding of the work their parents do. And if they can't come on the next one, at least they'll know it's not all fun and games for their parents. Well, not all the time. In San Francisco, I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes today. You can do a lot on eBay. You can buy or sell or browse. Now you can add social networking to the list. The online auction giant said today it's adding community features to encourage people to spend more time on the site. And consider this, the Marketplace hot tech tip of the day. If you've been thinking about creating a startup in hopes of a hefty buyout, social networking is probably the way to go. We learned today Google has bought a Finnish company called Jaiku. It's kind of like Twitter. It lets you tell your friends exactly what you're doing at any given moment. Like learning, for example, that Google shares rose today, up 1.6% to $625 a pop. Or listening to Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 85 points, 0.6%. The NASDAQ added 7 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 lost 2 points. That is 0.1% there. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on this program, lobster diving in Honduras nets big cash, but at great risk.
I said, look, wife, there is no other way I can support you and our family. I have to go out and dive. And I went out.
It's the latest installment of our series on the global economy, Working, it's called. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.